The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. I hope everyone has had a nice little mini vacation, holiday time off. Maybe you still are for a little while. If so, great. So, Merry Christmas. Happy holidays. Hope it was a safe, wonderful time. Friends, family. If you were by yourself, I hope it was still a positive experience. I'm trying to cover all the bases here because holidays, of course, can be tough for a lot of people. But in the end, hope it was a great experience, something that you can take with you years down the road. So the podcast today, it's going to be a two-parter with Daniel Speck, one of the owners of Henry of Pelham, which is located in St. Catharines. And Daniel, dynamic personality, really interesting guy. And he was so nice. We went for a drive before all throughout the different vineyards that he has. And it's impressive. Like, you don't realize until you get right into it how big it is, the expansive space that some of these wineries have in terms of acreage. And the funny thing is, I mean, Henry Pelham, like so many, they're not giant. These aren't giant, huge wineries. You know, this isn't like J.Lore or some, you know, huge company that makes 20, 30,000 cases of wine. So that was a really good time with him. And it's, as I said, it's a two-part interview because it goes on for a while. We talked for over an hour, and it's really interesting. And it's funny about his family history and the winery, where they are now, where they want to go. We learn about the Short Hills Bench sub-appellation. So definitely an interview where I learned a lot. And where this interview, it ends with actually us talking about the movie Das Boot. I know that's what you expected me to say. As for the holidays, just a big bag of carbs and sugar and booze. And I've actually enjoyed, you know, the last day and a half, just nothing. Just, you know, carrots and celery and vegetables and tea. I think I need a couple days. I'll never do one of those true detoxes. I could never do it. I'm jealous, actually, of the people that can go an entire month. There's no way I could go an entire month without having at least a glass of wine. I'll be at an event or dinner or friends, family, girlfriend. At some point, someone's pouring a glass of wine, and eventually the siren call is going to come, and I'm going to have, you know, I'm going to have a glass. I don't believe in any extremes about full cold turkey, but certainly dialing down. And also, I want to give a shout out to Jackson Triggs Merlot. My girlfriend's family was over here, and they brought over a magnum of, and it was open for a couple days. Like, so this is their traveler, this Jackson Triggs Merlot. And a lot of people are probably thinking, oh, cause you know, nose up in the air and you're not going to like it at all. But it actually wasn't bad. Like, it was a pleasant enough glass of wine. It was Merlot-y enough. I mean, it's not going to be, especially as the entry level, it's not expensive. You know, I wasn't expecting the true, full, plush, opulent, you know, whatever characteristics you want to think when you think of Merlot, because obviously it changes depending on, you know, if you get it from South America versus Saint-Emilion. But it was pleasant. Like, it was enjoyable to drink. Because I remember pouring it, going, okay, I'm going to cringe a little bit. Let's see. But, you know, it's, at the very least, I would call it good quality wedding wine. You know, when you go to a wedding and it's just horrible wine, but it's an open bar, you're at a wedding, what are you going to do? You're going to get drunk. This far, you know, high-end wedding wine stuff, you know, stuff you actually enjoy. So good on you, Jackson Triggs. And by the way, why is it, because I've been to a couple shows taking nephews out to a couple shows for us Christmas gifts, because we don't buy them presents, we buy them things. Why is it even like the nice theaters or the really nice plays where you're spending like $130, $140 bucks a ticket, and the wine that they have is so often just crap? It always amazes me. We're in this nice place. Everyone is dressed up, and maybe not, you know, suit and ties, but at least, you know, sport jackets, and everyone's dressed up well, and the event is great, and the night is great, and the performance is wonderful, and everything looks good. And then you spend, you know, $11 on a glass of wine, and it's just crap. Never understand that. Anyway, so here is the first part of the interview. As I said, it ends actually with us again talking about the movie Das Boot, a famous German black and white movie. But it's also in the middle of Daniel going through his three lines of Bacchanal Noir, because if you've listened to this podcast, you know I'm just not a big fan of that grape. I'm not going to name the wineries in Niagara, Prince Edward County, that just horrible. Like the sort of wine where this is what I would serve. This is what I would drink to try to stop drinking wine for a month. I'm like, oh no, Bacchanal Noir. I can't risk drinking something that bad again. Goodbye, wine. But it was sort of fun going through his three Baccos and, you know, what I liked and what I didn't like about him. So that's where the first part ends. And then we pick it up after that with more Bacchanal Noir talk. Also some fun stuff about the best movie or TV scenes involving wine. He's got a great answer. Mine involves Cersei Lannister. So anyway, there it is. Without further ado. I almost said a boo. That's good to end this on a high note. Anyway, here is from Henry Appellum, Daniel Speck. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast, joined by the VP of Sales, one of the owners of Henry Appellum. Daniel Speck is with me now. Daniel, thanks so much for doing this.
Thanks for inviting me.
And where are we? Because we are in a really cool spot.
We're in the barrel cellar at Henry Appellum Winery, about 20 feet below ground, and wine is being made around us as we speak.
And this is this is a great spot to be. You've hosted events here all the time. I was here with the National Club. You did a fantastic job just going over everything about the wine. There's so much I want to talk to you about. But just first, for people who don't know, a little history of Henry Appellum, because you guys are some of the OGs of Ontario wine.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to say we're the youngest people in the world, but we started this project at a young age, so sometimes people are a little surprised by that, about how long this winery's been around. It's our 30th vintage this year, 2018, so it's kind of exciting for us. My brothers and I are from Toronto. We grew up downtown. My dad was from Niagara, and my mother's from New York, and really, in the early 80s, this land that had been settled by our family, actually, back in the 1780s, 1790s, had mostly been sold off except for a small parcel that was still in family hands. And so my dad, on a bit of a whim, bought a small piece of it off one of our cousins who still had the Smith last name, which will kind of come back in a minute. And so he thought to himself, you know, get these kids doing something. I'm going to make them go plant a vineyard. Oh. And he shipped us out on weekends and summers to live in the old buildings here and plant a vineyard.
How old were you in that for that?
When we bought the land, I was in 82. I would have been 8. And really, it got active a couple of years later in terms of planting vineyards. And that was it. Paul, my oldest brother, had been between 16 and 18 in those days. So he had a driver's license. Yeah. And he got us back and forth.
What was those toughest days like for you physically? Like just planting? Because before this interview, Daniel and I, he took me on a tour and saw all the vineyards. And really impressive. And we'll talk about that as well. But that's not easy work.
It's backbreaking work. You know, I did 14 years of vineyard work, and when I was finishing up university, I was living in the States at the time, and I was seriously questioning whether I could go back and do the rest of my life in those vineyards. My brother Matt's a hero for that. He absolutely loves it. For me, I there's other things I would do.
You're studying philosophy. Yeah. You're like a philosophy major.
I was.
And now you're coming here and doing backbreaking work in the fields.
We all have philosophy degrees, actually. Paul, that's Matt, true. And I. Yeah. We're interesting evolution from philosophy to vineyard to winemaking.
And so I'm curious, let's go back to, I think it was around 1980, I think it was around 84 when you guys replaced the Concord grapes. That's right. And just, you know, and putting in more of your vinifera. God, I can never pronounce that right. So your more traditional grapes, your Merlot, your Gamay, you know, Chardonnay, things like that. What was the wine scene like in the mid-80s?
France was king.
Yep.
French wines were dominant. The California industry was emergent. Australia followed a number of years later, but it was that's what it was. The domestic wine industry was going through a massive transition across Canada. Free trade had been a big disruptor to our industry. Ultimately, there's good and bad in all of that, but ultimately it was a good thing because it put an emphasis on quality production. And so when we started making wine in 1988, from the beginning, our intention was to make premium, 100% authentic, locally grown wine.
How many other examples were there when you were doing that in 1988?
Ooh, I don't know, seven or eight perhaps.
How much insecurity was there? Because it's when you're the tip of the spear of any movement, on one level, oh, this is wonderful. We get to be the first. But being the first means you're in the dark. There's more mystery. There's not as much of a blueprint of success. Was there just insecurity of what the hell are we doing?
I think that we were in survival mode. We had a business in Toronto. My parents ran a small school, mm-hmm. a little high school. And through a number of events, a combination of the boom, bust, echo generation gap that came with that, a lot less teenagers in the late 80s. There was a big challenge with a recession that was driven by real estate in 89. All of that combined with we were spending money like we're drunken sailors.
Yeah.
Planting a vineyard and getting going. We were in a financial crisis personally as a family. So we were just focused on battening down the hatches and surviving and not thinking about,
You didn't have time.
No.
You didn't have time to think of the big picture.
Totally.
Because you're just dealing with the micro of every day of, are we going to be able to somehow afford this and survive another day?
That's absolutely the case. I think that's a trait that we carry on with today. I mean, we're in a very different place today, obviously, but we don't sit around patting ourselves on the back. My brothers and I have lunch together most days, 3 to 5 days a week. And what do we talk about? The business, our lives. And we talk about what are our struggles? How do we fix things? What can we improve upon? That's kind of how it is when day to day is what we get obsessed with.
All right. Some point I want to get to what are the main struggles today? But, was there an epiphany moment when you guys realized, because, reading the articles, you guys looked at the heat scans and that, the contouring hills and just that this land, this area, was conducive to making quality wine. Was there a moment when you guys or your family realized, wait a minute, we should be doing this versus just Concord grapes?
I think in the beginning, we were involved with a number of wineries, a handful of wineries, in establishing VQA. And VQA, the Vintners Quality Alliance, is an appellation of origin system, as you'd see in France and Italy and, now in the U.S. and elsewhere. And it defined some of the rules for what is truly authentic domestic production within Ontario and later in B.C. And that process was a good process for us to narrow down what are the quality markers, what should we be focused on, what is going to enhance be our special attribute as a wine region. For us specifically, being on the land that we're on, where we are is in the Short Hills Bench is a place that has lower vigor soils. It naturally produces a smaller crop per acre, so less fruit per vine, and more intensity of flavor. This is just fact. It's just what it is.
Yeah.
We didn't think that far ahead. We were investing in a piece of land that was close to us in terms of our personal family heritage. That was kind of an interesting idea for us at the time, or my dad especially, and started to plant a vineyard. If we'd known something else, we might have done something else, but it actually worked out very well because it's where we needed to be. Focus on premium. We couldn't take on the big guys.
Yeah. Talk about viticulture for a second. And this is for, and again, with this podcast, I'm always trying to straddle the line between the information for just people that are getting into wine and are starting to like it. Then you got the hardcore wine enthusiasts. And then you have the people in the biz and trying to find a way to for content for everyone. But I was wondering if you could explain for people that are just getting new into wine, why having soil that is low vigor, that actually is more difficult to produce lots and lots of grapes, why that's actually a better thing for the winemaker?
Yeah, that's an absolutely great question. So if you look in the history of winemaking, very often it was, vines were planted on the valley walls, on the hills, and the rest of the bottom of the valley where the soil is more fertile is where you would raise, you know, the animals, you would raise, you grow other crops. So fertile soils are good for some plants, less fertile for others. And, you know, so the valley walls, which are usually the cheaper and less quality land, were the ones that vineyards got planted on. And then as wine has boomed, those have become the expensive places. So wherever the less fertile soil is usually more desirable for vines. Oddly enough, it's kind of this weird thing. Well, why is that so? One thing is that a grapevine is a forest plant. So every vineyard in the world, which is planted not in a forest, right? Because no vineyards are planted in forests.
Yep.
By definition, we're imposing the will of man on that. This is taking it out of its natural environment. And the reason that think what a grapevine is. Well, let's start with what is a tree. An oak tree, for example, is this plant that grows a big trunk, big sturdy trunk, so it can stand up. And the oak tree wants to be taller than the next tree next to it, and so on. So there's a competition of species here. The taller the tree, the bigger the trunk, the more it can get the sunlight and shade the other guys and kill off its competition. This is what forests are about, yeah. Right? On some level.
Yeah.
Trees competing with each other, different species. Well, grapevines are a clever plant because their way around all this is they say, look, oak tree, while you're investing all that resource into your trunk, I'm not going to put any resources into my trunk. I'm going to grow a tall, thin little vine. I'm going to wrap around your trunk and use it as a scaffold.
Yeah.
Shoot right up to the top and spread my leaves on top of your leaves. And ultimately what you get is vines kill trees, right? So that's been their natural evolution. So the first way a vine likes to reproduce is when that tree falls over, because it eventually kills it. A grapevine can re-root itself. If the vine gets broken in half, it'll re-root itself. They're a tough plant.
They are evil.
Oh, they're evil. They clone themselves, right? That's literally what plant cloning is. So they don't really want to produce grapes. So when you take them out of the forest and you put them on a hillside or in a nice, well-drained piece of soil, what you're doing is you're taking them away from fertile soil and putting them on really tough soil. And that tough soil triggers the vine, the grapevine, into thinking, I may not be able to clone myself. I better produce grapes.
Yeah.
So you want them to suffer a little bit, but not so much that the vine is unhealthy. And if they suffer just the right amount, they produce grapes. So we're basically like plant sadists when we grow our vineyards.
And the key for, and people always wonder about yield. And the important thing is that the fewer grapes that are produced on the vine, it just means that those grapes are better quality because all the energy from the soil and all that you impact from the dirt below, it gets concentrated into a smaller amount of grapes. Is that the best way to explain it to people?
Absolutely. At a top level, that's exactly what we're trying to achieve. Of course, in everything, there's a limit, right?
Yeah.
So you can't reduce. If you can reduce the yield too far, and that makes no sense. And then what you just get is a bushy vine.
Yeah.
So I get more plant. So there's a balance in there of how many grapes per vine to hold back the growth of the plant, and vice versa. But in a nutshell, yeah, in balance, less fruit per vine is better.
How tough, it's a bit of a personal question, how tough was 93, 94? That's when your father passed away. And I don't want to get into the conversation about the losing of a parent, but more, you know, is you and your two brothers still relatively young, in debt and still trying to, you know, you're still working your way in the wine, in the wine industry. Just how difficult was 93, 94 for you guys?
So I just finished university and came back. Well, I finished in 92. So I came back just after my father, a few years after he passed away. It was challenging. My dad saw our first profitable year, which was wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we had to just sort all that out, like ownership and how we were going to proceed forward. And I think we did it the right way. We didn't fight over money, over ownership. We divided the company three ways, which aligned our interests with our intentions between me and my brothers. And we had debt. We had debt for sure. But the company had been growing like double digit for years, even though we had this massive debt. So there's promise there. And we just put our nose to the grindstone. And I think a lot of the early history of the business is as much about my brothers and myself learning how to work together and developing trust in those relationships as it is about growing the business. Had we not achieved that balance between each other, you know, it would have looked different.
That's interesting. I didn't even think about this, but a lot of credit for Henry Pelham Winery goes to your parents for just creating three children who get along. I mean, and also kudos to you and your brothers for being able to work together, because we always hear these stories, whether it's wine or for instance, I have a cottage up in Muskoka, and then you hear about, you know, when the parents pass away and then the kids fight over the property and then they have to sell the cottage because, you know, no one can figure it out. And it's the same thing here. There's tons of stories in France of just, you know, wineries getting splintered off. And I mean, that's a real credit to you guys and to your parents, because this company doesn't survive unless there's harmony among the brothers.
For sure. And I mean, and you know, we went to, we had two things in, that really helped us to this point. The first is we had a shared history between the three of us. And if you look at any people that become a nation around this world, it's because they have a shared history. Yeah. Shared history is an important thing. You can interpret that any way you want, but you can look at any great country has shared history. And I think in a family business, that there's some truth to that. The second thing is that I think was helpful for us. We went to a small school, my brothers and I, down in Maryland, a philosophy school. Well, but we also studied sciences and maths and
languages. St. John's College in Maryland.
That's right. And it was a neat school because, like the table we're sitting at here, you know, what, 8-10-foot-long table? That was the classroom. And it would have, you know, a dozen kids sitting around it and a tutor at one end. And we only read the great books of the Western canon. And so we would sit down and we'd be reading the Iliad, or we'd be reading Homer, Plato, or whatever. Yeah. And the kids led the discussion. And there were certain rules of discussion, including having to listen, not interrupting. And you could only use common references. Only things that we'd all read together were allowed in. So you couldn't reference what's going on in the news or movies or whatever. It had to be just the things we'd all read together. And that got built as you read more books together. And that gave us a language in the classroom, an honest language, and you got away from rhetoric. And it forced everyone to be hard on the problems and not the people. And I think that my brothers and I, having all gone there, came home with these common reference points, but also with a good sense of how to have discourse with each other.
By the way, my favorite part in the Odyssey is near the end when Odysseus says all the women, the female servants who had backstabbed, who were the traitors, and it's a really gruesome line. And he strung them up and was hanging them, and the line is, "Their legs twitched, but only for a little while." I remember reading that, going, "Damn, that's cold." By the way, your St. John's College. So many winemakers went there. Helen Turley makes killer Zinfandel. The winemakers of Marquesian, of Consgard, of Stag's Leap. Like, yeah. What the hell was going on at St. John's College?
Duckhorn and others, too. Yeah.
Duckhorn as well, really?
Yeah. Zach Rasmussen, he was a year ahead of me. Good friend. He's a good guy.
What did you guys drink back then? I mean, was it all high-end stuff? Or, I mean, what were you guys doing?
Pabst Blue Ribbon. Actually, Milwaukee's Best was my beer of choice because it was, I think, $7 at 2-4.
Yeah.
Cans. No, it's an interesting thing. It's there's no wine aspect to the education. It's just I think Helen Turley back in the 60s, she went there, and not long after or before, Warren Winiarski, who founded Stag's Leap.
Yep.
He was involved in the school. And his first wine he made, by the way, was when he was living in upstate New York, it was Bacco.
We're getting there in a second.
I don't know. It draws these folks, and a lot of. Then I think from some of the graduates, they became an on ramp into the industry for other people. There's a bit of a connection, you know, reaching back and helping students get into the industry that way. And it's a little subculture of the college. But in our case, it's just, again, it's a fluke. You know, we happen to be in the wine business, and then we went there, and then like discovered all this.
All right, you mentioned Bacco. Let me say on the front end, I'm a big fan of Henry Pelham. Your Riesling, your Chardonnay, your Pinot, the ones you were pouring for us at the National Club event here, killer. Like, just, I can go back and look at my notes, just fully expressive, varietally correct, depth, everything is there. So I'm saying that on the front end.
And I'm going to be honest with you because I'm not going to lie. I shit talk Paco Noir quite a bit on this podcast. And listen, you can't like everything. If you everything, you love nothing. It's always it's one of my philosophies. But we are going to try. You've brought three different Paco Noirs for us to try, which is fantastic because I want to give them a try. I'm open-minded. And this will be awkward if I don't like them, but you know what? We're going to try anyway. No worries. What do you? I figure we'll, you know, more questions and answers, but we'll do it while trying some of the Bacco. So, what have you opened?
So I brought three wines. The Bacco that started it all, what we refer to as our classic Bacco. Mm-hmm. I have our Old Vines Bacco, which is a newer edition, which is just doing phenomenally well, and then our Spec Family Reserve Bacco. So three expressions of the same grape. A little bit about Bacco. It was a grape that was developed in the southwest of France in the late 19th century. It was resistant to numerous diseases. It ripened a little bit early while maintaining acidity and deep dark color and juicy flavors. And it was very important for wine at the time. It was developed in Gascony, where Armagnac is from, and they still plant Bacco Blanc actually more and more today for the production of Armagnac. We discovered this grape in the early days of our winery. My mother was a big fan of Amarone and really wanted us to produce something like that. And it's interesting that she was a fan of that wine because our wine region has you know some things in common with the Veneto and northeastern Italy. I mean, so it's climatically our summers are similar. We grow Pinot Grigio. We make great sparkling wines, Merlot and Cabernet, as well as things like that. So there's a reason for that. But there's also a lot of Appassimento style wines being made here, which we dabbled
with.
Noticed
a bigger uptake in that.
Yeah. So there's some influence there, but we're our own thing. We have our own take, and Bacco is a great example of that. We like it because it ripens early, produces all these great dark flavors that we want. If you look at its history, if you look at take Zinfandel in California, Zinfandel was the volume producer, the filler grape for century anyways. Malbec in Argentina, exact same story, rustic big red, and it was grown for its production. It was very productive, not because it was necessarily the most interesting wine at that level of production. So too with Shiraz, Syrah, as we also know it in Australia. Well, Bacco was the same thing. It was grown here because it was reliable, dark, and produced a lot of grapes. And
it could handle the cold.
Could handle the cold too, absolutely. So along the way, though, what happened was Zinfandel. A few people started to take it a little more seriously and produce smaller quantities per acre, per vine of higher quality red, better barrel aging. Same with Malbec, same with Shiraz. And now you see, Penfold's Grange is, $600-$700 a bottle, probably one of the most expensive New World wines. People have found the way to produce high end wines from these, what are typically rustic. It's kind of like our indigenous premium grape variety, and that's the story of Bacco. If you go to Copenhagen, there's multiple Michelin star restaurants pouring Bacco by the glass. If you go to the UK, it's our most popular wine. We sell it to Japan. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I just got an email from a friend in Belgium. He's at some famous restaurant there drinking the Old Vines Bacco. So this is the wine that defines us. I would say increasingly defines our region. It's driving the growth in our region, and we're the lead producer. I think most people would say, and so we're happy to be a part of it.
All right. Well, which one shall we try first? Okay. And if you need to put your mic down to pour, whatever you got to do, trust me. I've done radio for so long. I can fill. It's one of my few skills is I can gas bag like crazy as you're pouring. By the way, you can't see this, but it's a great job. Daniel still holding in his left hand the mic and pours, and I don't even think there was one spill whatsoever. So good on you.
I'm going to say I could probably pour, drink, smoke, and dance at the same time.
So which one are we trying first?
So we always start with the classic. So what does classic mean for us? So Bacco Noir, in our classic range of wines, we like to think of them as a Niagara Peninsula expression. So it's going to be reflective of the whole region in terms of its character. But In this case, it happens to be a single estate wine. It's composed of fruit from vineyards that would be some of our youngest, and it includes our oldest vineyard. We drove by it.
Yeah. It's like 40-plus-year-old vines.
Yeah, there's a vineyard that is an heirloom vineyard that came with a parcel of land we bought that we've more recently learned is 43 years old. It was planted in 1975. And so our oldest Bacco actually goes into the classic tier. It's a small parcel, but it's an important contribution. And then you get from that this wine for the juicy, opulent style. Very much a crowd pleaser. Mm-hmm. I didn't bring the spittoon, so we're gonna have to just suck these back.
Well, we'll have to survive then. All right. So when you're describing this on the nose and the palate, what would you tell people?
So yeah. So I think the Bacco. I start with the color because you always see the wine first.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost black. I mean, it's incredibly dark.
Really dark purple, almost like a Malbec in a way.
Absolutely. It's in the same and in some ways it's a similar weight to Malbec, I find. It also has, when I taste it, it's got sort of bright, brambly kind of fruit flavors. There's the freshness there that you want, but it's also got like juiciness. It's like biting into a pomegranate maybe. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
if you've eaten a pomegranate, or you know, it's some of those even plummy and not so grippy. You know, some wines, for those who know what tannin is, like when you drink an espresso, that coarseness on your tongue is tannin essentially. This wine is not super tannic. It has tannin, but it's still gulpable. It's not gonna.
Yeah,
not
it's
gonna
a lighter. It's a lighter, more juicy version of a Bacco. And yeah, what I always tell people if they want to know what tannin is. Take a sip, treat it like mouthwash, get it up in the gums on your upper teeth, mm-hmm. and the drier, the more pucker you get.
Puckery.
You know, that's one way you can tell just how much the tannins. I mean, there's a variety of ways. That's just my very simple way of doing it. All right, so this first one. It's not as, I don't know, what I've never liked about Bacco is this funky, meaty spice thing going on that I've never been a fan of. This doesn't really have it. This one is juicier and it is light and gulpable is the right way to put this. I would say, you know, this is in a way it almost goes down like Gamay. It's not Gamay fruit profile, but this one's not bad. This one, and by the way, I am fully ready to sit and go, I don't like this at all. I am not, you know, because. You've already agreed to do the interview. We're already 25 minutes in. You ain't going anywhere. So I feel I could be critical of the wine.
You won't offend me.
And by the way, even if you drop the mic, then that's great because you know then it becomes like a Jerry Springer wine version thing here. This was not bad.
So I was talking to Eric Peacock, who runs our cafe here. Great guy. And he said something that I thought was interesting. He was asked, you know, what does Bacco go with, and some of those like tannic grippy reds, like you know, Well-Made Cab.
Yeah.
Because they're tannic, they need like rarer meats, which draws away the tannins. It's just a property of rarer meats. And it makes the fruit more visible, more tasteable. And Bacco is different. He said Bacco is interesting because it kind of goes very well with the more cooked meats. I mean, when you think of things you braise or you do low and slow on the barbecue, like ribs or you know, a nice roasted bird, roasted chicken, or roasted chicken that's got barbecue sauce. Bacco has got the tang to it and the richness of barbecue sauce in a sense. So it's anything that's been slow cooked, a stew, you know, anything that you like a little bit of tartness with, the Bacco is going to work. And it's got that almost sweet fruit.
Yeah, and the tartness is there and there's good acid. So that first one, and I say and it's not a negative, it's a simple, juicy red wine, and actually, that one was better than I expected. So that's your. Is that your classic?
Classic. It's Bacco Noir. If for people who live in Ontario, you'll find it in the main part of the liquor store. And
all right.
Yeah. Or Quebec, for that matter.
Yeah.
No, I got another glass for you. Okay. So if you want to compare, even to go back, you can.
Yep.
So I'm pouring for you now the Old Vines Bacco.
Okay.
Check
so this
that
is
for
one
cork.
We...
Make sure that's we're good here. Yeah, we're good.
And what's the story behind this one?
So Old Vines, we've got a lot of old vineyards. So Where with this particular wine, we're taking vineyards that are minimum 20 years old and older. So the classic is mostly younger fruit, could have a portion of older, but it's more about the expression of Niagara as a place. With the old vines Bacco, it's an expression of what old vines do. And old vines produce less fruit per vine. In this case, we're dealing with vineyards that, as I think I said earlier, the vines are old because they're good. They're not good because they're old. Because this idea of like, oh, this, you know, someone wants to hand down some antique in the family and you feel like obligated to keep this thing. You're like, yeah, but it's a piece of junk, right? Yeah. Just because it's old doesn't make it good. Well, these vineyards have been around this long because we love them and we've been preserving them and we haven't replanted them because the fruit is so excellent. So these are minimum 20 years old, up to about 34-year-old vineyards currently. And we just love these parcels. There's multiple parcels of old vines coming together to produce this exceptional wine.
Sometimes that's marketing, isn't it? When it's old vines, and the wine might not be that good, but if you say, well, this vine is 29 years old, which is much older than what you normally get in, you know, the Niagara region, then in a way it's almost, we're using this to sell the wine. We're not using quality. We're going to use the novelty of the age.
Absolutely. I mean, there's wine speak can obfuscate, you know, just even using, it can make it hard to understand. I think my brothers and I our view on this is that, you know, we've been around now for 30 years of making wine and longer with the whole vineyard project before that. We plan to be here for a lot longer and we have to build truthful relationships with the people who our customers are. And
yeah,
and so we want that to have some meaning and not just be bullshit. I mean, right? So that's what's behind this. Older vineyards that are more established that have been the great producers. Now, this wine is I'll tell you something about this wine. All of our Bacco is aged in American oak, and this particular wine gets a more generous dollop of newer American oak. And we love that in this wine. In the early days of Bacco, we did a lot of experimentation with French oak, and French oak is wonderful for the right wine. Mm-hmm. But French oak is very delicate, and we like to say that French oak on this wine would be like putting perfume on John Wayne.
Right.
It just doesn't, you know, yeah, doesn't work.
Yeah.
This is like
Old Spice.
You need Old Spice, exactly.
You need Karate?
High Karate.
High Karate. Yeah.
Oh, my God. You got to go back and check out the commercials on YouTube for High Karate. They're fantastic. I found a bottle at a yard sale.
Yeah.
And I gave it to my brother. It's so funny, though, the hands doing the chops on it.
Yeah.
That's great.
It was a different time.
It's another time. Yeah. A little less politically correct,
yeah,
clearly. So the Bacco here is, it's a muscular wine. It's got richness. And I think when you think of old vines Zin and old vines Malbec and this kind of thing, people expect a wine that's a little more muscular, a little more complex, again, more intensity of flavor, mm-hmm, more concentration, a little less on the juicy and more smoky.
Yeah, this one is a little more meaty, a little more smoky. It's a little bit of green. I pick up a little bit of green.
Eucalyptus or something, or mint.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, and the mint, see, part of that is my own palate. I have yet to find much red wine from Barossa or a lot of parts of Australia that I've liked.
This is where mintiness is a characteristic of the Shiraz, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like mint, eucalyptus, I'm not a big fan of. You know, I like my meatiness in my Cornas or in my Bandol Mouvedre. Here's what I can say about this wine. This is clearly a well-made wine that wouldn't be something that I would order. But it's the same way. You know what? You're a movie guy, and we're going to talk about movies in a second. It's like, I'm not a big fan of Scotch. Or whiskey. It's just never been my thing. But I recognize good Scotch. And so the reference I always give is Das Boot. I recognize this is a brilliant movie. I just don't want to watch a 3-hour black and white movie about a bunch of World War I German soldiers in a submarine.
Yeah.
It's just not for me. But I recognize it's great. I just don't want to watch it again. So that's how sometimes I describe a wine that is well made, but is probably not for me. But yeah, there's plenty of depth in this wine. It's varietally correct. It's balanced. You know, the alcohol isn't heavy. There's none of that. So I would say it's a well-made wine, but one that I probably wouldn't order.
So that is like such a funny thing you just said, because I literally just watched Das Boot about a week ago.
I did. Oh my
and
God!
I hadn't seen it since it came out in, I think, 1981. I saw it as a kid and I loved it.
Yeah.
And how old would I have been then? Probably 7 or 8. I loved the movie, but I hadn't seen it in 30-some years.
Yeah.
And I was one of those late-nighters. The whole family had gone to bed, and I was like, you know what? It's time for me to watch a German war movie at 3 in the morning with a bottle of wine. And you know what? It still holds up for me.
Yeah. It's a very
specific thing. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a very well-made movie. I'm not going to lie to you. I did not expect my Das Boot reference to be met with. I watched it last week.
I totally did. Yeah.
Thus ending the first part of my 101 interview with Daniel Speck from Henry Appellum. Thanks so much for listening to it. Part 2 is going to be released at the exact same time. It's probably in your mobile device, computer, laptop, however it is that you listen to podcasts. So part 2 picks up with continuing examination of his Bacco Noir. Why is it difficult to sell in Ontario? What does a tough vintage look like? Climate differences throughout Niagara. And conversations about the movie The Jerk, Dumb and Dumber, and Game of Thrones. It's all coming up in part 2. Thanks again for listening. Remember to tell your friends, family, coworkers, enemies, and get us on Stitcher, iTunes, Audio Boom, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.